As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Each week, The Athletic's tactics writer, Michael Cox, and its football analytics writer, Mark Carey, join me, Ali Maxwell, to discuss, well, varied footballing topics week on week. Our particular areas of interest are football tactics and data analytics within the game that we love. I've got Michael and Mark with me today to talk all things Manchester United and their new interim manager, future consultant, the Godfather, Ralph Rangnick. We're going to talk about him in depth, something of a life and times of Ralph Rangnick in footballing terms. We're going to get right into that. Michael, how are you this week?
Very good, thank you.
You've done some interesting work on The Athletic over the last week or so, most notably Pure Cox this. Who is the best player from each of England's 48 counties? I mean, they do give you a long leash, don't they?
Yeah, it was suggested to me as the best player from each kind of urban area. And I was like, well, it might be fun, but how about we do counties? Because no one ever talks about counties in footballing terms. But I was pleasantly surprised with some of the players that popped up, to be honest. Ivan Toney and Ollie Watkins and Ben White, all from areas of the country that you don't necessarily consider massive footballing hotbeds. But yeah, it was quite fun. I mean, it was an impossible thing to research and I did miss a couple. So the comments section was quite interesting as well.
You do your own research still, yeah? You haven't got too big for that.
I think this was a task where the whole fun was the research, you know. I was sitting there punching the air when I found out there was a footballer from the Isle of Wight who was a Football League regular. That was a particularly joyous moment.
I once did work experience as an 18-year-old at a very popular and excellent football magazine here in the UK. And this feels like the sort of research job that they gave work experience kids to do just to keep them occupied. So when I was there, I had to log the height and weight of every Premier League player, cross-referencing the Rothmans yearbook, the physical book, and using Google as well. And this struck me as the sort of thing that that you might have chucked the way of the intern. But no, of course not. Research, a big part of what you enjoy about the job. Adam B in the comments did request a follow-up on London boroughs, which, as someone from London, I would love to see. I would agree with. I think you'd probably leave that to someone else. Because I think a lot of people from London would look at Harry Kane being the pick for Greater London and have no arguments with that, but also feel like they're probably more attached to the borough. For example, for me, Wandsworth compared to Greater London as a whole. So I had a little look myself, and I want you to be the referee here, Michael. For Wandsworth, the borough of Wandsworth, I reckon in terms of men's football, it's between Callum Hudson-Odoi and Mikel Antonio. So who would win based on the criteria that you set there?
That's an interesting one. I mean, I'd probably go for Antonio for two reasons. One, because he's playing really well at the moment. But two, I also tried to include if there was a kind of marginal decision, if a player felt particularly linked to a particular area, I went for them. So, for example, I know Antonio played for, was it Tooting and Mitcham?
Tooting and Mitcham, yeah, there you go.
I'm not sure they technically are in Wandsworth Borough, are they? Tooting probably isn't. But he's got a real kind of South London link there. So a couple of a couple of other ones. I wasn't really sure whether to go for Ellen White or Leah Williamson for one of the counties. But when I found out that Leah Williamson had turned on the local Christmas lights in her hometown a couple of years ago, that was the kind of thing that swung it.
That swung it. Mark Kerry's with us. Mark, who's the best footballer from the county from which you hail?
Well, this is quite a controversial one in Michael's piece, where I'm from Worcestershire, and I think you're talking probably within a couple of miles that was Jude Bellingham was just on the right side of being in Worcestershire when, if you just listen to an interview with him, he's got a very strong Birmingham accent. But he'd be the one that I could, I guess, pin myself alongside, but not quite as talented as him on the ball.
Now, you're not allowed nearly as much frivolity with your work on the Athletic site. This week, you've been soaking in liquid Rangnick for your latest pieces. How have you found that?
Yeah, no, it was definitely a fun one. Maybe not quite as fun as Michael's, but I felt exhausted just reading about Rangnick's style of play, to be honest. But no, I enjoyed writing it. It was sort of delving into his formations, his tactical style, and importantly, how Man United, how far away they are from that style that he plays, which is interesting. So it'll be a big shake-up at United, I think, but it'll be interesting to see how they do.
And that is what we're going for today. I enjoyed the first line of your piece. The king is dead. Long live the interim king. Because, of course, Rangnick has agreed a six-month term of being Manchester United's interim manager. And then, I believe, has agreed a two-year consultancy role following on from that. So we really are talking today about Rangnick's style of play historically and how quickly he might be able to transpose that onto his latest project with Manchester United. Big game on Thursday night against Arsenal, but Michael Carrick will remain in the dugout for that game. Rangnick wrestling with the authorities in terms of work permits and things like that. And of course, Carrick took charge, Michael, of the big game on Sunday. Chelsea won, Manchester United won. And your piece reflecting on that game, you noticed a nice little detail in how he used Scott McTominay to defend, in particular, and improve a situation that United had struggled with in previous big games.
I mean, Chelsea, I guess now famous for the fact that their wing-backs keep on scoring. And Marcos Alonso came into the side. I know he frustrates some Chelsea fans, but is clearly a big aerial threat when the ball is wide. And it was just interesting to see Scott McTominay starting as a central midfielder but dropping into the defence, partly to help United not be overloaded by Chelsea's front five, but also just to deal with Marcos Alonso's threat in the air. So you had a centre-back dropping into centre-back to mark an opposition wing-back, which I don't think I've ever seen before, so I thoroughly enjoyed that.
And you presumably have got some Ralph Rangnick content going up on site this week. There's plenty on there already. Rafa Honigstein with the mega primer and so much other good stuff as well. John Muller's piece, as well as Mark's, is absolutely brilliant for understanding the numbers behind previous Rangnick sides. It's £3.33 a month. That is the current Athletic offer. If you're not a subscriber, but you'd like to read all of Mark and Michael's pieces and so much more as well, that's a 40% discount on a year subscription. Head to theathletic.com/tactics to sign up today. Michael, let's kick off with some top line stuff on Ralph Rangnick, who is or will be managing outside of Germany for the first time. Of course, he comes direct from Moscow, where he's been Lokomotiv Moscow's head of sports and development. What would you say are your sort of top line thoughts on this decision from Manchester United?
Well, I think he's a great person to have involved at the club. Clearly, he's taken on a variety of roles in recent years, particularly at RB Leipzig, who have progressed from nowhere to being one of the major clubs in Germany. And I think it's very obvious from listening to other managers speak about him that he's hugely respected. And I don't think there's any doubt that he, in a slightly peculiar way, almost kick-started the German obsession with gegenpressing, which has come to define their football to a certain extent, has come to define European football. I must say, I find the whole situation slightly peculiar with the fact that he's going to be an interim manager and then supposedly a consultant for 2 years. I've got various question marks about that in terms of how that shift is going to work, in terms of to what extent he's going to have a say in appointing the next manager. But also, I'd say mainly because interim managers aren't generally tasked with transforming the style of football. Usually an interim manager comes in, I think of Gus Hiddink or Rafa Benitez at Chelsea, and the dressing room's been a bit broken. You know, they're meant to kind of calm things there. They're meant to keep things simple tactically, get the big players on board and basically create some kind of stability for whoever's coming in next. But I mean, the way people are speaking about Rangnick, there's going to be a massive overhaul of the footballing philosophy, which is very difficult in 6 months and very difficult when, I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but there's so many games over the next month or so. So there's not going to be that much time on the training ground. So I'm fascinated to see how it works. And like I said, I think he's a fascinating character. But I think it's a tricky job with the kind of slightly peculiar roles he's been given.
Mm, yeah, it's certainly unusual, isn't it? He'll become the sixth German manager in Premier League history, but the third current manager, and with Daniel Farke having just left the building at Norwich as well, that's a clear recent trend in Premier League terms. In Rafa Honigstein's piece, he writes that the fact German coaches are so much in demand right now is a function of Jurgen Klopp doing well at Liverpool and the Rangnick conveyor belt producing a steady array of young, fiercely ambitious managerial talents who combine strong interpersonal skills with superb technical know-how. Throw in Tuchel's Champions League success with Chelsea last season, and there has never been more of a clamour for those schooled in the Rangnick philosophy. Michael, it does feel from my perspective like Rangnick's reputation has grown and grown outside Germany so much in the last decade, even though it's been his least active period in terms of actually managing a football team. It's only Leipzig whose dugout he has inhabited over the last decade or so, which adds a slightly unusual wrinkle to things.
Yeah, two of the last 10 seasons he's been a manager, one of which was in the second division in Germany. So it's very unusual for a club like Manchester United to appoint someone on the back of, you know, quite a significant gap in his CV. And I think it's been interesting. A lot of the kind of, I mean, there was a great piece, well, a couple of great pieces on the Athletic site this week, particularly the one by John Mueller, which took the statistics of his time at Leipzig and basically compared that with all other sides in the last few years. And I think that really gives an insight as to what he wants from his team. But a lot of the kind of preview pieces of how he'll manage have really been based around his quotes and interviews rather than his actual management, which again is a very unusual situation. I mean, you look at when Conte came, when Guardiola came, we were kind of taking a template of their past sides and putting it onto their new sides. It's less possible to do that with Rangnick, so people are dependent a little bit more on the very many interviews he's given in recent years.
I think as well, he's coming into a completely different situation, one that he's never come into before, where he's known to be the one to build up an underdog or build up a club out of nowhere. And he's coming into a club now, which, yes, requires kind of some rebuilding, but it's Manchester United, one of the biggest clubs in the world, where the remit is obviously very different. So how can we... almost what we're judging him on in his previous roles and success is going to be far different to what he's going to be asked to do in this role as well. So... this is why it's so interesting to see how he'll do, and we can do as many preview sort of pieces as we want, but it's a completely different side that he's coming into, club, status, etc. And yeah, this is why I think it'll be interesting.
We're mostly going to focus on the short term and on how he will turn this Manchester United side into one that looks like a classic Rangnick side. I suppose long term the questions are different. I mean, Rafa Honigstein calls him the godfather of the German coaching school, who will bring with him a vision of a United team playing organised, exciting, high energy football. And it feels like Rangnick's remit, easy for you to say, is to sort of start that journey before potentially being the main man to appoint, well, a godson to take the club forward in the mid to long term in future seasons. So it's a really interesting situation. Let's get into the specifics of his tactical history. Mark, you've done a lot of work looking at some of Rangnick's previous sides, as has John Mueller. One thing that we should mention, because there are managers such as Antonio Conte who appear to be so wedded to a certain basic shape or formation, not really the case when it comes to Rangnick.
Yeah, I think, well, kind of as you said before, he has very clear principles of play, very clear style of play in and out of possession. But I think that the formations can be quite flexible kind of within that. So he's largely known for his 4-4-2 system and variations of that. I think more specifically, the sort of the Red Bull model that many people will be familiar with is that 4-2-2-2 system. And you've seen it with Southampton, the likes of Ralf Hasenhüttl has sort of implemented that style of play as well. So often that's having kind of wide forwards sort of playing a bit more narrowly and picking up sort of positions between the lines and sort of creating overloads in more central areas. But it can be the actual formation itself can vary within that as well, in terms of that kind of high octane play in and out of possession. So he's been known to play a 4-2-3-1 quite often as well. A 4-3-3, I think he was quite successful with at Hoffenheim. And I think at Hoffenheim as well, it was a 3-5-2 that he was quite successful with as well. So it'll be interesting to see just kind of whether he will choose a formation with United of the above and kind of stick with that or very much adapt to the opposition and the players that he's obviously got at hand to be able to adapt like that. Yeah.
Michael, when we start talking about Ranić football and specifics of it, I think we should start with general principles out of possession first, don't you? Because that, it feels like, defines his school of thought more so than what they do with the ball necessarily.
Yeah, he's always been based around counter-pressing. That's been his grand idea, really. I think it's important to kind of point out the difference between just pressing and counter-pressing. I don't think his side's always pressed really, really high from opposition goal kicks and go chasing the ball in the final third. But yeah, it's all about that emphasis on regaining the ball as soon as it's lost to prevent counter-attacks. And also because when the opposition are starting their shift to an attacking phase, that's when they might be just dragged a little bit out of position and you can catch them off guard. And he's very specific in terms of, you know, he wants to win the ball back quickly and he wants to try and get a shot away quickly. So it's quite a intense and direct style of play, I suppose, to a certain extent. But it is based around that gegenpressing or counter-pressing concept, which I do think is slightly separate from pressing in general, which has been, a longer-standing feature of top-level football.
This is something I've sort of mentioned a couple of my pieces recently, where there's a clear difference between kind of making a high volume of pressures and having a good press. So obviously the press itself is very, very coordinated. So as Michael's saying, it's not necessarily just pressing from goal kicks, but that gegenpress being coordinated, structured. There's often pressing triggers where, you know, or everyone goes as one as well. So I think that there's obviously that clear difference between just making a lot of pressures and having a clear press. Another thing I'd say is that going back to that piece that you mentioned by John Muller, I thought it was a brilliant piece. And he mentions loads of different metrics within it, but kind of as an idea of just how Ranić likes his teams to play. We don't have too much data going back historically, but that 2018-19 season at Leipzig, he basically looked at every club in the top five European leagues over the last five seasons. And one metric which I thought was interesting to kind of pull out from a defensive perspective is pass completion allowed. So basically how much a team disrupts the opposition from kind of knocking the ball around. And in that season, Leipzig allowed the opposition to have a sort of, on average, a pass completion rate of 74.7%. So that was amongst the top 6% of all teams in those past five seasons, in terms of that's actually the lowest pass completion rate that they allowed the opposition to have. So I guess that kind of shows that they were disrupting the opposition from actually being able to, you know, string a few passes together. So it shows that they actually are having a coherent press and an effective one at that, because the opposition can't really knock it around very much.
Yeah, the standout sentence about pressing rather than counter-pressing from John's piece was, when defending against an opponent's organised build-up play rather than a transition moment, a moment of breakdown of possession, Ranić's team tend to be a little less aggressive than his reputation suggests. His preference for staying compact in defence instead of closing down as often as possible during organised phases shows in the zones where his team's applied pressure. So already we're starting to dig a little bit deeper than the top line press, 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 which is what you're going to hear a lot of. Not necessarily, Michael, expecting a front three at full speed all of the time when they don't have the ball, but moreover, more to do with organisation and very specific triggers. And mostly we're talking in moments of possession breakdown, moments of transition, rather than in the opposition's, you know, general build-up play.
Yeah, I think so. It tends to be a bit more conservative in that. A high-ish line, but a kind of midfield block, and then, like you say, certain triggers and they go as a unit. And yeah, I'd say it's more about recovering the ball just after it's been lost rather than going chasing the ball all over the pitch, which, yeah, with the upcoming run of fixtures, I think would be very difficult to sustain anyway.
And, you know, it's a long way to go. And Jurgen Klopp had a long time to implement it. But what are the tactical nuances between what we're talking about and, let's say, Klopp's Liverpool side at their heavy pressing best? Because I don't think Klopp is considered one of the godsons of Ranić, is he? Not to the same extent as a Tuchel or a Nagelsmann.
No, you're right. I mean, slightly different schools, but yeah, a similar concept, I'd say. I mean, Klopp's early days at Liverpool, I thought, was just, it was so frantic. And his Dortmund side as well was so frantic. And I think Klopp has actually reined that in a little bit. I remember when he was at Dortmund and he used to basically be challenging his players to run as far as they could and was giving them days off if they cumulatively recorded over 120 kilometres of possession, distance covered in a game, which you just think, I suppose it's 10 years on, but you just think, I can't imagine anyone talking in those terms anymore. So yeah, it's a bit more controlled. It's quite a structured way of playing. I don't think he gives his players much freedom in terms of, certainly not without the ball, but even within possession, I think it's all quite controlled. So yeah, it's different from Klopp, where I think Klopp gives his attackers a fair bit of freedom to kind of express themselves and do what they want to do after they've recovered the ball. Not sure you'll necessarily see Cristiano Ronaldo given a free role by Rangnick. But we'll have to wait and see, because at the end of the day, he's never coached a player with anything like the reputation or the status of Ronaldo. So that will be interesting.
I mean, Hoffenheim, their remit was to sign players. I think not a single player signed over 23 in many transfer windows, and Leipzig as well have always trended very young, haven't they? So that is certainly an interesting aspect of the man management job that he has on his hands. You're listening to the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, and still to come on this episode, Ranić ball with the ball. That's up next.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, Michael, a side like Manchester United, who are expected to win titles, that is Ranić's remit in the short, mid and long term, everyone's remit at Manchester United, in fact, it's assumed that this is a side who will have plenty of possession, because that tends to be the way for so-called big six clubs in the Premier League. What does Ranić football look like in possession, if you had to sum it up?
Well, he wants the ball move forward quickly. I think that suits Manchester United. They've got a lot of quick forwards who like going in behind. They like, I said, running forward, to put it very simply. I think Bruno Fernandes as well always wants to play the killer pass. Maybe at times does that too much, but I think his return of assists justifies the fact he does give the ball away quite a lot. United don't really have any controlling midfielders. I mean, I can't really imagine how Pep Guardiola would do if he came in with this Manchester United side and found that really they don't have the midfield players that you'd like to really control the game. But they do have players who can pass forward. They've got lots of attack. I mean, they've got such an incredible number of attacking talents. I don't really know how you fit them all in one team, but maybe Ranić will give it a go. He always says things along the lines of he wants a shot within 10 seconds of regaining the ball. I think that works well in the Bundesliga. The Bundesliga games are generally quite open. Most sides want to play positive, technical, German press-based football. Maybe it's more of an issue in the Premier League when, at Old Trafford, Manchester United will face a lot of teams who want to sit deep and fewer teams who want to become involved in a kind of open, engaging game of football. I think there might be times where just saying get the ball forward, shoot within 10 seconds is not necessarily conducive to success. And you might have to be a little bit more patient, work the ball from side to side and break teams down a little bit more gradually. But it, to me, it does feel broadly in keeping Manchester United sides of the past who did, whether they played counter-attacking football or dominant football, they did get the ball forward quite quickly. And I think that will be the greater emphasis here rather than long spells of possession. They will have a lot of possession, but probably more because they recover the ball quickly rather than because they're desperately trying to keep it.
Yeah, I do agree. I think that what I read recently was kind of as the headline is possession with a purpose, which I think is quite interesting as well. And I mean, Man United fans probably got a memory long enough to remember the Van Gaal days of just passing it around sometimes for the sake of passing it, and it was death by football at times. So I think just having that exciting possession with a purpose of, you know, as Michael said, Ranić wanting his side to get the ball forward when possible and when relevant. I think he doesn't like sideways passes or backwards passes only when there's a ball that actually could go forward. So rather than it not being backwards or sideways at all. But I was going to come back to John's piece, and maybe I'm just waxing lyrical about his piece, but I think that there's another really interesting sort of stat that he used in terms of in possession of that Leipzig side, just as an indication of kind of how he likes his team to play, of progressive pass share. So essentially, of all of the passes that Leipzig made, how many were progressive? And this is defined by, this is FBref's term of saying it's completed passes that move the ball towards the opponent's goal at least 10 yards from its furthest point in the last six passes. So completed passes that move the ball towards the opponent's goal at least 10 yards from its furthest point in the last six passes. So a bit of a change in direction from the previous passes, or it can also be a pass that's into the penalty area. And essentially, Leipzig had 9% of their total passes were progressive, and that was more than any other team in those past five seasons, other than last season's Atalanta, which I thought was quite interesting. But it goes to show just how much they are looking to play it forward when the opportunity arises. So again, we'll expect to see Man United hopefully creeping up in that statistic as well.
I mean, it sounds exciting, to be honest, the style of football and the way that you guys talking are about his principles both in and out of possession. Certainly an interesting question that you raised, Michael, about how easy in the Premier League compared to the Bundesliga is it to manufacture transition based football, basically in a league where compared to the Bundesliga most teams don't want to dance to that tune. I suppose that has to be one of the big questions. But go back to the exciting part of it. Can we expect a lot of goals? I mean, a glance at his Bundesliga record, and although he's only managed 10 games so far in the Champions League in his career, I think it's 3.8 goals per game, total combined goals in those games. It feels like we might expect quite a lot of excitement in games involving Manchester United.
Yeah, I think, absolutely true. I think there's, kind of as Michael said, and you both said at the start, there's not a great deal of data to kind of go from because historically he hasn't managed all that much recently. But I think, you're right to say that there'd be likely to expect goals. I dug into that same season in Leipzig, 2018-19 in the Bundesliga, and they averaged 1.9 goals per 90 in the Bundesliga, which was actually the fifth highest in the Bundesliga behind Bayer Leverkusen, Hoffenheim, interestingly, Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich. And that from that same season, which I think maybe it's because of the high press that they work so hard defensively to sort of keep it away from their own defensive third, but their defensive record was actually the best in the league that season. So they actually only conceded 0.8 goals per 90, which was better than Bayern Munich, who obviously were the league winners that season. So it kind of just shows that as much as he is going to obviously improve the attack, I'd imagine, given obviously he's got so many good attacking players, we sort of forget that given that style, it'll actually help them at the back as well.
Michael, this is someone who's pretty dogmatic in footballing terms, who has inspired so many that he's worked with, is very, very demanding from what I've read for every employee at the club in which he works. How preposterous would it be for me to suggest that there is something of a German Marcelo Bielsa?
Yeah, I think there is that comparison in the emphasis on pressing, albeit in a slightly different way. And also in the fact that his reputation is greater really than his achievements, I would say, as a manager. And that's maybe a little bit harsh on Bielsa. I mean, he's won a lot of things throughout his career and did a fantastic job with Chile, got Athletic Bilbao to the Europa League final. But both of them, I think, really they have their reputation because of what their protégés say about them. And just as I think Bielsa's case was helped by Guardiola speaking about him a lot over the last 10 years, I think the same has been true of Tuchel speaking about Rangnick, for example. I think there's a similarity there.
there was a lot in Rafa Honigstein's piece that made me so excited to have Ranić in the Premier League. There was one bit that was something of a red flag for me, and it was about off-field stuff, really. Power struggles. Quoting from Rafa, at Stuttgart, he immediately came up against a problem that would follow him around at other top-level engagements. The same people who hired him to bring in change lost their nerve when those changes threatened the existing order. Ranić's reformist zeal lost traction amid the complex power structure of a club that's never happy at the best of times. I mean, A, that seems a little like Ranić, perhaps like Bielsa, if he's your coach, manager, consultant, director of football, whatever it might be, you do need to live by Ranić, die by Ranić. And I just worry that the current hierarchy at Manchester United, Michael, they don't scream, or they don't have a history necessarily of being particularly good at that.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a chaotic arrangement, actually, that's happening. At Manchester United, certainly he's a great person to have around, but the structure at Manchester United has always been very confused, I think, over the last couple of seasons. There's various people who I don't quite understand their roles. Obviously, there's going to be a change in terms of Ed Woodward is stepping down. Then there was chat he was going to be retained as some kind of consultant. Don't understand on the basis of what, considering how chaotic his choices have been over the last few years. I find the Rangnick thing slightly peculiar, and I think people tend to, you know, talented people like Rangnick tend to succeed when there's a clear job for them and they have clear responsibilities. And I think the responsibilities of his role as interim manager, then 2-year consultant, I think there's a big question mark there.
Yeah, and to sort of have that, you have to be kind of all-consuming across the whole of the club, exactly as you say, Michael. And just to pick up on that last point, that's what I find the most interesting. I know we touched upon it in the start, but the structure is a six-month deal and then a 2-year consultancy, which, given that Ranić's sort of remit in his success has been long-term and hands-on, the role in this appointment seems to be short-term and potentially hands-off in terms of that consultancy. So I might be missing something in just what that consultancy will go on to be, but it just seems like in order for him to sort of implement what he wants to implement, it needs to be kind of all consuming. And just quickly, just to read something from Rafa as well, that in his piece, he said that Ranić hired people for jobs that hadn't even existed at the time at football clubs before. So a video analyst, sports psychologist, he had complex training sessions that put players under maximum mental pressure to make it sort of more authentic to a real game. And like, will he be able to implement all of those things and really be afforded the time and responsibility to have a shake up? Or is he just, I don't know, making a short-term change? It just confuses me a little bit.
And I think with the consultancy, I mean, that's such a broad term. It could mean anything. I mean, that could mean that he's almost a director of football in everything but name, because I think Manchester United already have a director of football now. Or it could mean that he's really not doing that much and he's just on the end of the phone to give advice when needed. And the reason for that is that, well, he had a long-term deal with Lokomotiv Moscow. He wasn't going to leave that kind of contract for 6 months of work at Manchester United. So they needed to, you know, give him something a bit meatier that he could sign up for. So, yeah, again, I don't have any doubts about Rangnick's capabilities, but I don't really understand his role. And of course, it's presumably going to, you know, his consultancy role might differ upon the identity of the next manager. There's certain managers who might come in and wants his advice and wants them hanging around. Others might want control over everything. And I mean, if I was Manchester United, I think I'd be a little bit more dutiful to the wishes of the manager rather than someone who's a consultant, just because I don't really know what a consultant does at a football club, because it could mean 100 different things.
Well, many questions about his style of football have been answered. In doing so, we've raised some other questions as well, which will probably be left unanswered for the moment, more of a wait and see brief. But in the final part of this Athletic Football Tactics podcast, we're going to look at the Manchester United squad that Ranić has to work with, and particularly which players may benefit or suffer from the changes in the pipeline.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So the last quote from Honigstein's piece, I promise. I mean, he was literally on the podcast last week, and we've probably heard as many of his words on this piece, but that's because he is the godfather of German football writing, at least to my eyes. A big piece on Rangnick involving the quote from Rangnick himself saying, "To develop, educate and coach, you need to be sure what kind of football you need to play. That's what all the top coaches in Europe have in common. They know what their football looks like. They have a video of the perfect game in their heads. The job is to transform that idea of football into the heads, hearts, brains and veins of the players. That's motivation, the transfer of belief." So let's take a look.
The hearts and the veins. Interesting.
He was getting good at interviews, wasn't he, Michael, as you mentioned earlier. So let's take a look at the heads, hearts, brains and veins of the Manchester United squad.
Actually, head and brain, I'd say, is roughly similar as well. It's basically two. He's got the brain and the heart, hasn't he? And I think head and veins are similar to those two things. Well, would you agree?
Whatever it is, it's got me pumped. Mark, another question really is that in previous jobs, we must remember that what has come before doesn't mean that the same will happen again in the footballing world. And certainly when it comes to managers, I think that's something that we need to be careful of. But we can't get past the fact that in his last two major jobs with Hoffenheim and with Leipzig, he had very young squads to work with and made them younger in the transfer market as well. Just give me an overview of Manchester United's squad age profile.
Before I sort of answer, I guess you're right in terms of he wants a young side, he wants a young squad. But again, the remit that he's kind of working with in terms of Manchester United, a team who is sort of wanting to win and win now, more often than not, then again, the remit is slightly different. But it's actually interesting that when looking at the age profile, it's actually building off something that Tom did as his parting gift to us in terms of looking at the peak ages of the respective positions of each peak age, that Manchester United's squad is very, very close to exactly at its peak right now. So it is built to win right now. So they have 8 players who are in their peak, which is up there with as many as anyone in the Premier League this season. So you combine the senior experience of Cavani, Matic and obviously Ronaldo, and you've got the youth of Greenwood, Sancho and Rashford, and you do have that real blend of peak experience and youth as well. But looking at again, that 2018-19 season, RB Leipzig had the youngest squad in the Bundesliga, 23.5 years old. So again, it shows that he does like to work with young players. The remit will be different at Manchester United. But I was also interested to see that he actually likes to, judging on this season at RB Leipzig, he likes to work with quite few players or have quite a small squad, in the sense that he had 23 players used that season, which was only Borussia Mönchengladbach and Bayer Leverkusen had fewer that season. So I guess it sort of shows that maybe, again, it was because of the tools that he had, smaller squad, because it was a different remit for a team. But would he like to kind of keep that small squad as tightly as possible to implement the principles that he wants? Or will he just use the whole wider squad at Manchester United? I don't know.
Well, we can assume that the football is going to look very different compared to their play under Solskjaer this season, which means changes afoot, and that will suit some players more so than others. Let's play a game of good news for bad news for Michael in terms of the Manchester United squad. We'll start at the back. I mean, in terms of the defence, the centre backs, it feels like the biggest change for them will likely be the height of the line. I was going to say the depth on the pitch, but you can't be both high and deep, can you? The height of the defensive line will be an immediate change, you'd think, and that comes with, you know, different skill set required. Are there any Manchester United defenders that stand out as maybe looking at having more minutes or fewer minutes under Rangnick, if that's a key part of his play?
Yeah, I'm interested in this. I don't quite know what his preferences would be. I think of Harry Maguire as someone who's very aerially dominant, and I think aerial dominance is less important the higher you are up pitch. I always quite like Lindelof, actually. He seems to go under the radar a bit, but I think of all Manchester United defenders, he's been the one who's been guilty of the fewest mistakes in recent weeks. And is good on the ball as well, can carry the ball forward, which could be a part of that. So, I mean, Varane, you think when he's at full speed, will be starting. But yeah, I'd be a little bit concerned if I was Harry Maguire. Obviously, the club captain, so he's got some status there. But he's not one who I think looks comfortable on the turn at times. We saw his the first booking of his red card at Watford was a classic example of where a runner got in behind and he had to haul him down. So yeah, maybe he's the most at risk.
What about a fullback? Because we've done whole podcasts about how the very top teams of the Premier League, Manchester City and Liverpool and Chelsea, the three currently, how they use their fullbacks and how crucial they are to build up play, to attacking output and all of those things. With Manchester United, you have a few different options. Wan-Bissaka at right back. I'd be interested to know whether you think he fits or not in terms of the sort of style of play that we're discussing. And also Luke Shaw, who in one of the many pieces I read about Ranić this week, it was mentioned that previously, I think he was doing an interview, he was asked about Manchester United and he questioned whether Luke Shaw was good enough to get them to the very top. So at one point, if not now, he wasn't a huge fan of Shaw's output. Michael, Manchester United, the defensive midfield zone has been the sort of loudest issue over the last year or two, but it strikes me that fullback is certainly a big area to improve on for them.
Yeah, it was interesting to see Tellez play at the weekend in place of Shaw, who's had a really difficult season after being pretty good at the Euros, I would say. And had a good last season as well. Yeah, I don't know about Wan-Bissaka. I mean, the thing is with Wan-Bissaka, it was such a big shift to playing in a Hodgson side to playing at a big side like Manchester United. And I don't think he's ever really had the coaching of like a top modern manager. So I still think there is potential there. But certainly the Wan-Bissaka that we see at the moment, I can't imagine is particularly suited to Ranić's football. I wonder if he might do something mad at right back. Might he play McTominay there or something like that? Just someone who's really energetic and, you know, physical. And I think just in terms of attitude, McTominay is the kind of player that he might like to have in the side. I can't necessarily see him as a long-term central midfielder. But yeah, maybe there's an option to do something a little bit quirky at right back.
In the centre of the park, what sort of attributes are we looking for here? I mean, from what you guys have said, you're going to want midfielders who are willing and able to progress the ball quickly. You don't need too many touches with the ball because, you know, quick forward progressive passes are going to be the order of the day. And not necessarily creative passes necessarily from the base of midfield, but just good decision makers almost more than anything. It strikes me from what you guys have said, you know, we talk a lot about physical skills required and technical skills required. To be a central midfield player, dare I say, in a Ranić side, you know, it's a question of mental skills as much as anything else. It's being able to think quickly. It's being able to contain and then act upon the information that you're given in terms of pressing triggers and in terms of how to move the ball forward. So there's all these different parts that go into being an elite central midfielder. And I wonder which of the current crop of United central midfielders, Mark, perhaps stand out to you as being those who might benefit or suffer from this.
Yeah, well, benefit and suffer is sort of two things that I sort of had in mind, because I think starting with who might suffer, actually, I think McTominay, given that he can be quite frustrating kind of on the ball sometimes, where he does choose that sideways or backwards pass, that safer pass. And I think on Sunday, I think Fred got frustrated at him for not actually passing forward when there was the option on. So I think that kind of on the ball, McTominay, he's not the most active presser anyway, but he's quite defensively disciplined. But he might sort of struggle to implement that kind of progressive passing, I think. I think on the note of Fred, I think he is, I sort of wrote in my piece that he is very active off the ball. He has the highest volume of pressures per 90 of anyone in the Manchester United squad. But then almost the other way, he's actually not that great on the ball himself in terms of getting the ball forward as well, and sometimes making silly decisions. And Sunday aside of making the silly decision of actually in the penalty box, I think in more of the centre of the park, he's sometimes not the best decision maker. So I think there's pros and cons to McTominay and Fred, but I think it could be an option for Van der Beek to actually get a a decent chance. I think he can't get much worse for him. But I think that because he's very technically gifted, he's able to play in more of a deeper central role if you asked him to. I think that he could be someone who, on a technical level, kind of as you say, Ali, he could benefit. So I think it will depend. I think the early weeks will sort of find that out. But I think Van de Beek might actually get a bit of a run in for once.
Michael, we saw Nemanja Matic in the heart of their midfield on Sunday. Do you see him getting more minutes or fewer minutes?
I can't tell because I think he is quite an intelligent player. And like you say, speed of thought and that kind of thing is important. But he's never been the most mobile Matic, even at his peak. And so I do fear for him a little bit. I'd like to see Rani be a bit more positive in midfield. And I don't think it's inconceivable. You could feel Fred as the deepest player. And then maybe Fernandes and Van de Beek, who I think are both capable of pressing. They're both energetic players. A three like that, I think, could work well for now. I'd prefer it if Manchester United had a real top-class holding midfielder to play in there. But they don't. So yeah, a little bit more of a positive tilt to the midfield could work.
It certainly feels like a team tactical setup where Bruno Fernandes could thrive. I mean, most tactical setups are such where a player like him could thrive. I wonder, in terms of his pressing, he's clearly very up for it, but not necessarily always executing in the right way, if you know what I mean. I don't want to dig anyone out, but very notably that first goal in their heavy defeat to Liverpool, Fernandes picked up a lot of flack for pressing the goalkeeper for really no real reason. It was kind of reminiscent of a puppy chasing a crow in a park, more so than something more strategic. So it feels like one of Ranić's jobs will be to encourage Fernandes to continue that physical output in pressing, but try and make him a little bit smarter. I mean, I watched the Chelsea game on Sunday, and don't get me wrong, Jorginho is one of the smartest at controlling the ball, shielding it in tight spaces, turning away and playing a smart pass. But it did strike me as quite funny how much Fernandes pressed Jorginho, and, you know, at the drop of a hat, Jorginho would have spun him and played past him. So something for Fernandes to work on, but quite exciting to think of what he could be if he could improve on that front in particular. What about attacking midfielders, wide men and strikers, Michael? Got quite a big group of players here. It'd be interesting to know which you think should be rubbing their hands with glee at this appointment.
I think you'll like Sancho. I mean, Sancho played at Dortmund, broadly similar system, I suppose, in a way. The one I'd worry for in the short term would be Mason Greenwood, just because, just looking at the way he pressed in a couple of, I think it was the Liverpool game, just almost looked like he'd never really been taught how to press. And it reminds me of when the young lad Oliver Burt went to Leipzig. And I can't remember if it was Rangnick or Hasenhüttl said he's starting at zero in terms of pressing.
They said more specifically, they said he was like an empty hard drive, which is an incredible, like, I mean, actually eviscerating mean when you think about it, but also an incredible use of language.
It is. I think of that as, yeah, that is, you're right. That is quite harsh, isn't it? Hopefully they don't say the same about Warville when he arrives. Yeah, I just wonder about Greenwood. In terms of that pressing, I mean, not saying he can't learn it, and he's the kind of player who long term I think will really benefit from working under, hopefully, a top class coach in the long term, as well as just for the next 6 months. But yeah, his pressing hasn't really impressed me so far.
Yeah, I agree with Greenwood. I think that Sancho will benefit as well. I think that Rashford, when channeled in the right way, will also benefit. I think that we're all kind of ignoring a Cristiano Ronaldo shaped elephant in the room, I know that we sort of touched upon it, but I think that I sort of wrote it in the piece that he's known to be a player who's not going to make a lot of pressures. I mean, there's undoubted ability on the ball, that's fine, but obviously it's off the ball that is sort of key to use as the stick to beat him with sometimes. But I don't think it's suddenly going to be that he is going to make a high volume of pressures and really start to just run about. It's not his game, it never will be, but there is going to be either a compromise from him a little bit in terms of sort of wrote that he might just be a bit more kind of careful in shepherding the opponent more towards a pressing trigger or blocking more kind of passing lanes and not exerting too much energy in that regard. And I think that Ranić will no doubt adapt as well. And I think we said before that he's not dealt with the superstar status of someone like Ronaldo. So I think there'll be an element of compromise from Ranić as well to to try and fit Ronaldo in within the principles and overall kind of system of play, but maybe adapt accordingly. Sort of, maybe we'll see something different for the first time in Ranić's career to try and get the best out of Ronaldo as well.
I think compromise is probably the most apt word that's been said on this podcast so far when we're talking Ranić at Manchester United. The last line I'm going to nick from someone else's work on the Athletic site was part of John Muller's piece where, having crunched all the different metrics to try and sum up and explain Ranić's playing style, he then compared all of those metrics to the 20 Premier League sides. And Manchester United's style of play under Solskjaer, in all of the metrics that John looked at, had them as the third most dissimilar team after Newcastle and Norwich to Ranić's RB Leipzig side. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Southampton were number one, coached by former RB Leipzig manager Ralf Hasenhüttl, one of Ranić's godsons. And that just speaks to, well, I think this is an incredible footballing interest story. From, you know, leave aside the name of the club and the name of the manager and the name of the players, if you're into football tactics, this is a fascinating case study, you know. And compromise has to be a big word. If we consider Manchester United to be at one end of the spectrum currently or previously, and Ranić's sides to be at the other end, how far can they get in 6 months of Ranić being in the dugout? How much further might they get in the long term when Ranić, we assume, will be part of the next hire? It's all absolutely fascinating. And I think, you know, you guys have given so much information. You've answered so many questions for me, but there's so many that have been raised as well, because there's also compromise in terms of off-field stuff, power struggles, hierarchical structures, and all those sorts of things that we don't tend to worry too much about on this podcast. I'm really, really excited about this. I'm excited about what's to come, intrigued for sure at how quickly this style can be implemented. I'm fascinated by the decision that the hierarchy have taken. Ralf Ranić there, covered as best we can on this week's podcast. This has been the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. A huge thanks to Michael and to Mark for their insight. More of that can be found multiple times a week, of course, in written form on the Athletic site. And you can sign up today if you head to theathletic.com/tactics. £3.33 a month for a year. That's a £40 discount on a year subscription. Head to theathletic.com/tactics. But equally as important, make sure you subscribe to this podcast feed, because we are weekly and we'll be back next week with another episode. Always grateful that you choose to listen to us. Thank you so much. And for any feedback that you send our way as well, always welcome. That's it from us. We'll see you next week on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.